Let's go to chapter 28. And back to Jewish families. Okay. So now Isaac, and now everybody knows, right? Esau knows, Rebekah knows, Isaac knows, Jacob knows. Everybody knows what happened. And what happens next in chapter 28, this is after Rebekah tells Jacob to run away, because she doesn't want to lose two kids in one day. That is, she's already lost Esau, presumably lost his love, right? Which, by the way, assumes that Esau is going to know that Rebekah did it, right? Why would she lose Esau just because Jacob tricked him, unless Rebekah figures out that Jacob couldn't trick him by himself, that it must have been Rebekah who did it? I don't know how he finds out. Maybe Jacob says, wasn't my fault. Mom made me do it. So she says to Isaac, I'm disgusted with my life because of the Hittite women. This is the end of 27. If Jacob marries a Hittite woman like these from among the native women, what good will life be to me? So Isaac sent for Jacob and blessed him. Now, there's a lot that's not being said here, right? That is, Isaac doesn't say anything to Rebekah about why did you trick me. They have no dialogue whatsoever about what just happened, which is awfully strange if you think about it, because presumably Isaac, if he was unhappy about being tricked, would have said something to Rebekah, but he doesn't. So I don't know whether you see this as Isaac's passivity, or maybe he wasn't so unhappy that he was tricked, or maybe the Bible just doesn't record the dialogue. But it is a strange thing that they never blames her for what just happened. So Isaac sent for Jacob and blessed him. He instructed him, saying, you shall not take a wife from among the Canaanite women. Up, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel. When was the last time we heard the name of Bethuel? Right, exactly. When Eliezer went to get... And up your mother's father, and take a wife from there among the daughters of Lavan, your mother's brother. And remember, we've known Lavan from before. May El Shaddai bless you, make you fertile and numerous, so that you become an assembly of peoples. May he grant the blessing of Abraham to you and your offspring, that you may possess the land where you're sojourning, which God assigned to Abraham. So, yes. I don't know, El Shaddai is usually, the name El Shaddai is usually associated with power, usually, not always. The one other association that I've seen with El Shaddai, which is one of the names of God, is at the beginning of Bereshit, at the beginning of Genesis, one commentator says that El Shaddai is the God who says die, who says enough. In other words, God created the world, but only part of the way. And then God stopped. And the rest of creation is up to us. So those are the two associations that come to mind. I don't know. The prefix El was very common in the ancient Near East, not just among Jews, right? There were lots of El. So what probably happened was that people took their God and added El something onto it. I just got this book. This is a really interesting little book, and I promised the author that when I read it, I would I'd try it out on the Torah class. But I have actually just started to read it, and I'll tell you why I did that. It's called The Hebrew Bible, New Insights and Scholarship. So I bought this book, I bought it off off Amazon just because I had read something about it. And then what does it begin with? On April 13th, 2001, the headline in the Los Angeles Times read, and then he goes on to tell the story of what happened here. So I wrote him and I said, guess what, I bought your book. And he said this was written for lay people to understand modern scholarship. You'll see why you reminded me of it. Anyway, that was when I gave the speech about the Exodus. So, yeah, exactly. Good. That's not a bad thing. So she said, here today, gone tomorrow. But the reason that I bring this up is I just started to read it, and the first essay is a really fascinating idea. The guy says, what if there were no Bible? I'm going to try to reconstruct the history of Israel from what we know of Israel without the Bible. That is just from archaeology. What if we were like the Philistines and we just knew what we uncovered in Israel? And one of the things that he does is he talks about, so you're talking about pottery, inscriptions, you know, digging stuff up, and writings of other cultures, Egyptian, whatever, that have nothing to do with, which is a really interesting way of thinking about the history of Israel. And so he talks about how often certain divine names appear in ancient Israelite sites. How often does Yahweh appear? That is Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. How often does El Shaddai appear? How often do all those different names appear? And he has a count here somewhere, but he says, to illustrate these data, names like Hoshayahu, Hanayahu, Yehoyab, all those are names from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, right? They're different combinations. And among the names with El are Eliur, Eliakim, Elishama, and so on. And so you might think that they worshipped one god named El and another god named Yah. But since we know that El is a common Semitic element for god or deity, that's what you reminded me of, we have reason to believe that the people who lived in these mountains considered El and Yahu to be one and the same. So even from the archaeological data, he sees monotheism in Israel, which is a kind of just an interesting way of going about it. And now I fulfilled my promise. I use the book. So I'll write him back and say, worked great. This is one of the interesting things and the blessings of being able to have a state of Israel. That is, we can do research on our own history. When we didn't have Israel, we actually couldn't do that. Okay, so Isaac sends Jacob away, and he doesn't say to him, what you did was wrong, and he doesn't say to Rebecca, what you did was wrong. He just sends him away. And I don't know what we're supposed to know, what we're supposed to assume about that silence, but it is an interesting silence. He goes to Padan Aram, to Laban, the son of Bituel the Aramean, the brother of Rebecca, the mother of Jacob and Esau. Why do you think all that's included?
Yeah. Is he subjecting his son to his own fate? He was sent away to.
No, he wasn't sent away.
Was sent to take him.
Yeah, but he wasn't sent away. Isaac is the opposite. Isaac's the only one who never went away.
Right.
Abraham went away, Jacob went away, Joseph went away, Isaac stayed home.
But he's sending him to
where his wife came from, which is what, I mean. That's what he would do. He doesn't want him to marry anyone from around there because the locals have caused him a lot of trouble. And notice, by the way, Sarna has an interesting comment here where it says, kum lech, which means up and go, right? But if you look at what Rebecca says in 43, verse 43, she says, kum barach lecha. What is barach? Anyone know? Flee, run. So she doesn't know. Isaac doesn't seem to know that Jacob needs to run. So maybe it wasn't clear. I mean, he knew that Esau was upset, but he didn't know that he threatened to kill him because Rebecca wants him to run away. Jacob just figures he has to go find himself a decent wife. I don't know why there is this recapitulation unless it's for the reader. That is, Laban, the son of Bituel the Aramean, the brother of Rebecca, the mother of Jacob and Esau. Because, you know, sometimes when you read novels, characters will say things that they wouldn't normally say in life just to let you know what, you know, because you don't remember that their mother from 100 pages ago was named Anne. So they'll say, my mother Anne, right, which nobody actually says, but you need to know that so that you can keep up with the story. It's possible that that's part of what's going on here. And the other possibility is that they want to tie the two homes together because what happens to Jacob at Laban's house will obviously be what builds Israel, right? Yeah.
Going back to the prior point where nobody says anything about what just happened with the blessings,
yeah.
And also with the Akedah. Nothing is ever said after that. Is there ever a story where we turn around, where we hear the characters turn around and say,
what just happened?
Yeah.
I have to think about it, but there is, I mean, for example, with the golden calf, then Moses and God discuss the golden calf is the first thing that comes to mind. But I don't know if in Genesis, if any of the family stories of afterwards, that there's a little bit with Joseph after he gets sold. You sold me, you intended to do bad, but God intended good. So there is some, but you're right that there's certainly a pattern of not going back and reflecting on what just happened. So I don't know. Okay. Now, the next major story, we can finish this chapter. The next major story is going to be Jacob's encounter with God and the ladder, but I'm going to save that for next time and go back over all the questions that we've asked about this one. All right, when Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him off to Padan Aram to take a wife there, charging him as he blessed him, "You shall not take a wife from among the Canaanite women," and that Jacob obeyed his father and mother and went to Padan Aram, Esau realized the Canaanite women displeased his father Isaac. So Esau went to Ishmael and took a wife, in addition to the wives that he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, sister of Nevaiot, is the way it is in the Hebrew. Now, let me just say, this seems to me clearly one of the ways that you could solve the problem of mother-in-laws and daughter-in-laws. You just take another wife that your mother likes, right, in addition to the ones that you already have. So, yeah, had I stumbled on this before, I could have saved a lot of hours of counseling with various couples that come to me. I could have just said, it's okay, marry her, and just get somebody else afterwards that your mother likes. But what actually, the reason I point this out is that you notice that it says he didn't know that these wives displeased his father. It doesn't say he didn't know that they displeased his mother. She's the one who complained about them, right? Then Isaac turns around and says to Jacob, don't get a wife from here, go get a wife from there. And when Esau saw that Isaac was upset about it, then he went and got himself a new wife. Yeah. So you interpret Isaac here as doing what's going to be good for Rebecca, because he figures Rebecca is going to be the one who's going to... Right. I, by the way, it's probably more true in the generation above us, but not only. I just think we haven't gotten to that stage yet. But I mean, it's still true that women are going to outlive men, by and large. And so it is still true that men are going to have to think about, as a general rule, what are the family arrangements going to be when I'm not here? So, which is something, this is a constant struggle. A little advertisement here. This is a constant struggle that the cemetery has and the mortuary has, Mount Sinai. They're always trying to get people to make what are called pre-need arrangements. Pre-need arrangements are you go in, you arrange what you want in terms of where your grave is going to be and what your funeral arrangements are going to be. First of all, because you save money if you do it in advance. And second, because that way, if you die tomorrow, your kids don't actually have to do that for you. But most people don't do it, first of all, because they don't anticipate dying tomorrow. And second, because they don't want to face the disagreeable task of doing that. But the truth is, it's an act of love to do that for people who come after you, so they don't have to face it at such a terrible time. It's also a good investment, right? Real estate in LA is always, always a good investment. Anyway, so, but that's what, what's that?
We wait a little while, the price might come.
Yeah, exactly, right, these days, yes.
Don't you think it's interesting, though, that Esau went to Ishmael's family, considering that Ishmael
and the relationship between Ishmael and Isaac, and that they are with, you know.
It's true, but he has no other, Jacob already took Laban, so that's the only other family running around. But yeah, they are, and there is some kind of spiritual kinship between Ishmael and Esau, I think. It feels that way, you know. What's that?
Similar personality.
Yeah, they're not, you know, they're not the studious ones in the family. So that ends the story of the deception. So now let's go back, and I want to offer you a little bit of the interpretation of from Nechama Leibovitz. First of all, she talks about, speaking of Purim, she talks about something that the Midrash says. Whoever maintains that the Holy One is a foregoer means someone who forgets, basically, you know, who doesn't collect on debts or make things even, forgets that he is merely long-suffering, but ultimately collects his due. Jacob made Esau break out into a loud cry. And now we're talking about chapter 27, verse 34, if you remember the cry. Right? It says, when Esau heard his father's words, he burst into wild and bitter sobbing. Okay? Vayitzak tzaka gedola umara ad ma'od. A wild and bitter sobbing. Jacob made Esau break out into a cry once, and where was he punished for it? Vayitzak sa'aka gedola umara. Guess where that line is almost repeated, almost verbatim? Megillat Esther. The Jews of Shushan broke out into a cry with a loud and bitter cry, right? So, now, this says several things. First of all, the rabbis always hear, since they know the Bible intimately, when they hear the same phrase, they connects up right away. But also, it tells you that there's a part of the rabbinic conscience that doesn't like what Jacob did. Because obviously, God makes Jacob, they say, Jacob suffered for it. And we would never think, obviously, that the Purim story is a result of Jacob having stolen the birthright from Esau, but there is this similarity in the verbal formula, right? Both of them cry a loud and bitter cry. Yes?
He doesn't cry a loud and bitter cry when Joseph is sent off with the Midianites?
Nobody cries a loud and bitter cry. He mourns. Jacob mourns. In fact, he mourns over much, but I don't think the phrase is the same. I can tell you what the phrase is. It says, it should be, let's see, one second. It says, one second, they're selling him now. And he rent his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and observed mourning for many days. All his sons and daughters sought to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted him. Vayef oto aviv, which means he cried for him. So, okay. So that, anyways, I find that interesting that they obviously think that there's something illegitimate about what Jacob did, and that's why they, that's why they see him as having, yeah.
Concealing.
Right. There's concealing in both and hiding in both. Esther hides, pretends to be something she isn't, then has to reveal herself. Jacob hides, pretends to be something he isn't, and then reveals himself. And both of them have happy endings, right? This one does too. Actually, in the end, despite Esau's pain, nobody gets killed. The Jewish people get to continue. I mean, in as much as this can have a happy ending, it has a happy ending. All right, so that's already the struggle, but many commentators have been surprised by Isaac's seeming lack of discrimination in his insistence on blessing Esau. Why is Isaac so insistent on blessing Esau? Doesn't he know that Esau is a man of a field and Jacob a simple man? Couldn't he have blessed both equally? And then various commentators go through this. We've talked about this. One second. I have to make, there's the next page. So if you look at the blessing of Esau and the blessing that was meant for Esau and the blessing that was meant for Jacob, the blessing that was meant for Esau is chapter 27, verse 28. Okay, this is the blessing that he was going to give to Esau, but he gives to Jacob. All right? May God give you of the dew of heaven. Do you see that? And the fat of the earth, abundance of new grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brothers and let your mother's sons bow to you. Cursed be they who curse you. Blessed be they who bless you. And then the blessing that he was going to give Jacob is on the next chapter. May El Shaddai bless you, make you fertile and numerous, so you become an assembly of peoples. May he grant the blessing of Abraham to you and your offspring, that you may possess the land where you're sojourning, which God assigned to Abraham. So Esau was promised abundance, fatness, power, and dominion, material blessings, but the mission of Abraham was actually saved for Jacob. So what Jacob stole from Esau wasn't the mission, at least according to this interpretation, which was always intended for Jacob. What he stole from him was the wealth, the material goods. Yes?
God spoke to Rebekah when Jacob came out of the room and said that he was going to be the nation.
Yes.
Can we assume that she never told Isaac, or did she tell Isaac and he just said, sorry, I'm going to do what I'm supposed to do, which is to come out this blessing, and that she had to trick him in order to fulfill God's prophecy to her?
What do you think? Yes.
I think she told it. I think either she told him and he rejected it, or she knew her husband well enough to know that she shouldn't tell him because he would reject it, so she had to trick him.
So, I would say this. It seems to me pretty clear that Isaac is in the dark about this, because if there is a controversy, such a big controversy about it, you would think that Isaac would have reported it. And I would guess, I mean, I'm trying to work backwards. So Rebekah receives this communication from God. It is very rare in the Bible for God to speak directly to a woman. She must assume that God's speaking to her and to her alone, because this is something that's meant for her and not for Isaac. And Rebekah's personality is not such that she's, you know, she doesn't come from a group model. She doesn't say, everybody, let's do this, right? She breaks away from her family. She meets the guy at the well. She decides she's going to go with him, and she goes. Then she supplants takes Sarah's place after Sarah's died. And really, the only time she appeals to Isaac that I remember, that I can tell, is when she's in great pain and basically says, you did this to me. Right? So I would guess that she never told him. And the only thing that leaves is, why is there such a silence after she does this? So I don't know. There are a couple of possibilities. So I just read a novel by an Irish novelist named Maggie O'Farrell, where the part of the novel is essentially a woman has a long-standing affair, and when she tells her husband, he basically says, you know, tell me something else I didn't know. And she says, well, why didn't you ever say anything? And he said, because it seemed to me that from saying something to you, once you decided that this was what you were going to do, saying something to you would only blow apart the family and cause hurt. Now, it's in the context of lots of other things that happen in the novel, and you can think that that's a good or a bad decision, but I think it's not all that uncommon a decision. To know something painful and choose not to say it because you can't imagine any good would come of it. So even if Isaac suspects that Rebekah wants to do this, he's not going to change Rebekah's mind. He knows that. So maybe that's what you're seeing in all the different shadings of whether Isaac knows that he's being tricked. Maybe he does know and he doesn't know. That is, part of him knows that Rebekah's going to get Jacob blessed one way or another, but he doesn't want to actually have it out with her because it'll just blow apart the family, and he's not going to persuade her otherwise.
The blessing that he gives to Isaac, the actual blessing of chapter 28,
It's the one, it looks to me like Jacob is saying, I knew who the right person should go to, and if you guys did not trick and not do all the promotion, I would have done the right thing to begin with anyway. Mm-hmm. Because the blessing says that I'll give you the land. You are going to. I mean, it's a much nicer blessing, actually, than mm-hmm. to have it stolen.
Yes. And it's the blessing that mentions Abraham, by the way. The other one doesn't, right? When you invoke your father, right.
You guys did all of this for nothing.
That's a nice way to read it. I kind of like that. That gives Isaac more substance than we've been giving him so far. Yeah.
In the next verse, it's pretty confusing about be master over your brothers.
Right.
And let your mother's sons bow down to you.
Mm-hmm.
Who are we talking about?
It's going to be Esau. I mean, it's got to be either Esau or Jacob. Right? It's one brother. There are only two brothers. So it's got to be one or the other. Right. So the question is which one it goes to. But in history, it could work either way. And also, it's not clear exactly what it's going to mean, since the truth is that they don't have that much. Later on with Edom, they do. But I mean, you could make the argument that that blessing has to go to Isaac, has to go to Jacob, because otherwise Israel's going to serve Edom as opposed to Edom serving Israel. I don't know. Part of it is I really do think that some of these blessings are probably formulaic. And the older brother gets the your younger brother will serve you blessing. Right? That's just the way it works. And he reversed this. And I don't know that it necessarily means that your younger brother will serve you. We may be taking it more literally than it's meant. Blessings tend to be, you know, I mean, when we take a bar bat mitzvah child and we say, may God's countenance shine upon you, what does that mean exactly? So you interpret sort of metaphorically, you know, may you always be in God's presence. But it's, you use, in fact, when I bless my daughter on Friday night, I say, Yivarecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, which is a blessing in the male, not in the female, right? You don't change the gender when you bless a girl, because that's the way it's written in the Bible. In other words, it's a formula, and that's the formula you use to bless a child, even though it's for a male child as opposed to a female child. So I don't know whether how much this is formula and how much this is intended really to say your brother will bow down to you. Yeah. The same, I would say, for the exact same reason. Yeah. Although, yes, exactly. I wouldn't say Ben Imecha. Also, because she, who knows, she could have another child. I mean, miraculous things have happened in the Bible. Or maybe she had children we're not told about. That's also conceivable, although not
by Isaac.
What's that? Not necessarily by Isaac. Yes, possible. Although it's much rarer for a woman to have a child by another man than it is for a man to have children by other women in the Bible. So,
I want to share a personal thing. This was the parasha for my youngest child. And you can imagine the anguish we all went through, the youngest child talking about this.
Mm-hmm.
I was very pleased, actually, because what came out of it in his darash was how he respects his older children and how his family has not put him in that position to let one overrule the other. How harmonious it is that birth order does not play such a role, at least in our family.
Well, I think you could certainly argue that this is no guide for child rearing, these stories.
I was wondering about that. Yeah. Like, if you take this as, all right, what lesson do we take? And we go first Cain and Abel. Maybe the lesson we're learning now is sibling rivalries. Rather than just stick around long enough to get hit, you run away.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the separation is a plus in some cases. It's a
yeah, I mean, for Jacob, it was the only way that he could become who he was. I don't think that the lessons of almost any of these stories are lessons of emulation, that therefore you should act like Jacob, or therefore you should act like Isaac, or because by and large they make questionable choices, but part of that is also to say that God's design works despite the choices sometimes that human beings make, right?
But isn't that counter to what the Orthodox believe?
Mm, yes.
So they say this
yes.
is your car manual.
Right.
You how to run your car. The
Bible yes.
You how to run
well,
your
that's one of the reasons why Midrash tends to whitewash biblical characters, because it says that actually, the you know, it's very hard for the rabbis to say Jacob did something wrong. And you'll find rabbinic comments like that Midrash that will say it, but it's very hard by and large for them to say that because it's Jacob. So, if you study it depending on how wide their sources are, and if you've looked, for example, in the Stone Chumash, it's very rare for them to say anything negative about any biblical character. But it seems to me to be, to make the story much less, at least much less interesting. Stories where people are all good and all bad are much less interesting than when people are people and they're combinations of good and bad and they're struggling with it. And that's, you know, that's the only kind of character that I think you can learn from. But you remember, those of you who were here when Reuven Firestone was here, and he talked about how in Islam, the heroes are all good. And they look at the Bible and they say, no wonder Jews are so messed up. Look at their heroes, right? All their heroes are ambiguous. But we like that. So I wouldn't want to take that away. Yeah.
Isn't that also why we don't bless our children on Friday night with the blessing of Abraham
right.
and Jacob, we bless them with
Ephraim and Manasseh. Right.
And that even that was the switched hands and, you know,
yeah.
the older and the younger.
I think so. Let me put it this way. That's the way modern interpreters and more offbeat traditional interpreters would read it. But again, if you go to a very traditional Torah study group, they won't read it that way. Right? They'll read the characters as fairly straight, even when it's obvious. Even when it's obvious and condemned in the Torah itself, like with David and Bathsheba, when you it's really bad to send a woman's husband away to war to be killed so that you can sleep with her. That's a really bad thing to do. But even there, there are rabbinic interpretations that try to exonerate David, even though in the Torah itself it condemns him. So I really think that a large part of this comes not just out of the Jewish tradition, and one of the reasons why we don't do that in this room, a large part of this comes not out of the Jewish tradition, but the Jewish historical situation. When you're surrounded by cultures that attack you and point to your Bible and say how terrible the people are that you admire, you defend them. That's just what you do. I mean, when someone attacks your family, you actually make them sound better than they are, because someone's attacking them. So we did that too.
Yeah, but it seems to me that fits the building the fence around the Torah and
Well, that's a halachic term, building a fence.
What I'm saying is
yeah.
that what it actually seems to have done is it prevents the layperson from doing their own interpretations in a sense. You go through the tradition in a certain way, but by entering the fence, you actually get, and looking at the Torah as showing humans who have errors and the struggle of good and evil in all of them, you actually get people to identify with it more and be closer to the source. If you keep building the fence, then people leave it without even knowing what they're leaving.
I obviously agree with you, because that's the way that our movement and this class and so on teaches, but we all understand the counter argument too, which is it also desacralizes it, right? It makes it less, this is what God tells you and this is what you must do and these are the people who exemplify exactly the way you should behave. So, I'm on your side, but we should recognize that that's not the way, at least the traditionally many people saw it, yeah. Yes.
Because power
Well, yeah, you have, in fact, one of the, I think, who was it? I can't remember which king that abdicated. When they asked him why he abdicated, he said, because I would rather have been killed by my enemies than my children. Because there was a lot of, you know, fratricide in, and it's true that when you look at ruling powers, it's not just that power corrupts, although there's certainly some of that. It's that any people's desires get pursued, and when it's power, there's power. When it's wealth, well, the same thing. I mean, there will be no battle in my family over inheritance, right? But the reason that there won't is because there's no inheritance to battle over. I was just kidding with my parents about it. I said, you did us a great favor, all of us. But if my parents had millions and millions and millions of dollars, there would be reason to be worried. Even though we all get along and we're all nice guys and there are four of us and I'm sure they would divide it, there still would be reason to be worried, because as soon as there's a possibility of someone else getting more, all the normal human emotions come into play. So it's very, you know, it's tricky. Wealth, power, they're ambiguous legacies. They clearly are. I mean, anyway, so, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, this whole idea of blessings, it seems there's more going on than is meeting the eye. It seems like the real blessing, the Abrahamic blessing, is almost an afterthought. Certainly, it doesn't have the same drama as the other two blessings. And, you know, I wonder, was Isaac planning the whole time to give him this blessing? Is it only because everything else has happened and now he's in a sense way that he's going to give him this blessing? It's a little odd, because it seems like this should be the major blessing that's talked about, but it's sort of after everything else that's happened is, okay, you're going, let me quick give you this blessing and bye.
I don't know the answer to that. It's very hard to figure out. You can see Isaac lots of different ways, and I don't think there's a convincing, there's an interpretation that's completely convincing to the exclusion of others. But let me refocus it this way. Really, ultimately, this story is about Jacob, because Jacob's the one who's going to have to carry this on. Really, whatever Isaac was in this story becomes less relevant than the fact that Jacob got the blessing. However he got it, he got the blessing. And Jacob's the one who's going to become Israel, and he's the one who's going to have all the children, and he's the one who's going to bring them down to Egypt and make them promise to come back. And his story is by far the longest story of an individual before Moses. And most of Moses' story isn't really about Moses, right? Most of Moses' story is about Israel. I wonder if you counted up the number of narrative verses about someone's behavior, if Jacob would be the longest one in the Torah other than, in the whole Torah, other than David. Right? David's is the, for my money, is the most interesting story, because it's the longest and most complicated story in the Torah. And maybe we'll do that one day. But Jacob's really, as a study of his character, because Isaac is almost like a blank screen and you can project on him what you want, it's harder to figure out why Isaac acted the way he did, right? Even when we were talking about what Isaac might have done, nobody said, because we have this long pattern of conduct by Isaac. We don't really, but with Jacob you do. And Jacob clearly changes and grows over the course of the Bible. So my question in part is, what interests me more looking back over the story is, why does Jacob do what he does? Is he so ambitious that even though he wants to do this, he wants to make sure his mother takes the blame for herself? Because that's what happens, right? He says to her, but I'll get caught. And she says, don't worry, it'll be my blame. And he goes, okay, well, if it's going to be your blame, right? He doesn't say that, but that's what effectively happens. As soon as she says, don't worry, I'll take the blame, she doesn't say to him, don't worry, you won't get caught. That would be the logical thing to say, right? So he still thinks he might get caught, but he won't get blamed. And that's consistent with the Jacob that we saw in the field, who says to Esau, really, you're starving? You're that hungry? So sell me the birthright. It's a very, very calculating, person. Very, very manipulative and calculating. And that's, that, he to me, is a much more interesting character to think about than Isaac's. You know, he's his mother's son. He's really his mother's son, because she also knows how to get what she wants. It's just that she's a woman in a society where she has fewer options than Jacob. Like, you couldn't have sent her away the way, if Jacob had been Rebecca, you could send her to get married, but you can't send her away the way Jacob's sent away by himself to have an adventure, right? Which is what he'll have in the next Parsha. You know, he'll have the dream of the ladder and the angels descending and ascending. You couldn't do that with a woman, so.
Putting what Miriam said with what Rob said, I'm thinking, as much as you said it is about Jacob, yes, it is about Jacob needing to grow. And if it was premeditated, Isaac's blessing, that he, in effect, with all his apparent passivity, he kind of outdid Rebecca, that kept the better mm-hmm. blessing for Esau, who didn't need all the trauma or the adventure that Jacob had to go through.
Right.
So he set the record right with Esau, gave him the best blessing, kind of pretended to be numb and passive throughout, and then Jacob had to go through these trials and adventures to grow, to become a better person.
So talking about this and talking about the way that all of us are reading this as a character study just makes me think, to bring it back to close, to bring it back to God for a minute. So if God is orchestrating all this action and making sure that Jacob becomes the blessed and Israel and so on, then you have to admire the fact that God does it with as little intervention as possible. All God does is say something to Rebecca. That's it, right? But that's enough, knowing the characters involved. And maybe it is, you know, we always come to this question of whether God knows what's going to happen or not. And if people have free will, how could God possibly know? But if God knows his characters, that is, knows what Rebecca's like, then he can be sure that all he has to do is say to Rebecca, the younger will be served by the older, and Rebecca will take care of the rest. You know, I mean, it's not with Moses and Egypt, it's a much bigger job. You need constant discussion and constant monitoring. But with Rebecca and the family, you know, I mean, you know that it works that way in some businesses, right? There are some people, for example, in the synagogue who I know if I say this really should get done, that I don't have to call them the next day and say, by the way, did you do this? Because it'll get done. And God knows about Rebecca. If he says to Rebecca, this will happen, and maybe all of this is just an unfolding of God's will through Rebecca, who's God's agent, and then God has the job of making Jacob into his agent, which takes some work, right? Jacob's tougher to corral, yeah, than Rebecca, so.
Okay, going back to what yeah. all of you said right now, it looks to me that basically the most important blessing is the one that he gives at the end, the Abrahamic.
Yes.
And the reason that all of that commotion happened was just a distraction to say, you know what? You know, sometimes, let's say you want the kid to do something and distracting with something else.
Mm-hmm.
So people will think, or Esau will think, that that was the main blessing. And I wish I got that. And how come I didn't get that? And what is fussing about that?
Oh, it's misdirection.
The main blessing comes in.
Did any of you ever do magic tricks? Did any of you ever do magic tricks? Magic tricks are all about misdirection,
yeah.
Right? You have somebody look in one place, and then you do something in the other. So maybe this is sleight of hand.
The blessing was the main blessing, but all of that happened, so Esau would never know.
Right.
And even
we don't realize, right, that he gave the really important blessing to Jacob, always intended to, and just, it's a nice idea, I like that, yes.
Jacob also.
Oh. Hold on one second, yes, go ahead.
Oh,
no, go ahead.
I don't understand why is the last blessing the best, better than the first?
Only because it carries on God's mission. That's what she's saying. But you could argue it either way, because it says that you'll be the bearer of God's mission, of the mission I gave to Abraham, which is the most important.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if Jacob had to run away, then he lost the wealth as well, right? He had to run away. So he didn't get the land.
He does in the end, it seems, because he comes back, but he doesn't get it right away. Yeah, but he does eventually. Yeah.
It seems to me that there's an interplay between Jacob's wanting it and his get his being chosen, that in some ways that his,
right. Right.
His he was
I like that.
Not necessarily the kid that was going to win in the fight and all this sort of thing. They were pretty close in age since they were twins, but he was he really wanted his destiny, and something about destiny and the quest for it is in this book as well as the other parts. So he really hungered or was struggling or had an
he was ambitious.
But I think that there's I think that that makes it too much like the first blessing. I think that
I see what you mean. Yearning is deeper than ambition.
I think that the yearning for your destiny and connection to Hashem is the underlying thing in this whole story. And Isaac's encounter with Hashem was pretty frightening. He already had his. I mean, he had his right. On the altar, and he was already much connected in whatever way we interpret that. But it was which of the twin was yearning not just for the power and the wealth and the usual and all this and making it a little better, but there's something deeper about somebody who yearns for something that has more meaning in life. Right?
So I ask you, following that thought, think about it. Do you see Esav as having a yearning for God? But you do see Isaac as having that yearning. So that's why Isaac has to go on a journey. Because, you know, there's, I'll take the comment in 1 second, but there's a lot of work about narrative structures and what stories are. And there's an old idea that there are only two kinds of stories. One is a stranger comes to town, and the other is you go on a journey. And all stories can be reduced to one of those two things, right? And this is a you go on a journey. The first part is a stranger comes to town. That's Rebecca, right? And then the second story is Jacob goes on a journey. So Esau is not the person to go on a journey, but Jacob is. Last comment, and then I'm sorry, I have to end a little early today. Yeah. Right.
So it shows in a subtle way that Esau took a wife without his parents' blessing. So it gives a little bit of fit. And then he goes right. And gets another wife from Ishmael, which is not the best family.
Right.
Okay. So I think that this is the only place that I feel Jacob was a better person
than Esau was to be chosen. Because, well, if what you want from someone is to carry on the family legacy, and here the family legacy is God's legacy, then it has to be Jacob. It has to be Jacob. Because Esau does, you know, it's hard to say. We have a model in America of independence. And we think the more independent, the healthier. But for a lot of human history, the more you carried on time-tested, traditional ways of life that succeeded, the healthier you were, and the less you were able to do that, the less healthy you were. So I don't know that one model is correct and another is incorrect. It's very hard to say that about human beings. But clearly the Bible struggles with both. It has both, because Abraham breaks away from traditional family things, but he's starting something new and it's God's, and so if you can be a part of it, that's the healthier way. But all through the Bible, there is that struggle between people who can be a part of it and people who can't. And in fact, the struggle continues to this day. All right. Thank you. I look forward to seeing you next week. Next week, Jacob's Ladder.